Accession number 28708, Reel 2.
Shelter, whereas over in Cairn, the instant this first peep of the siren, everybody was down in the shelter, and there'd be five of us. Of course, it was right next door to the naval barracks, and where they had some bit of damage in there, but right, quite close to Goshen Street and Ocean Street, which were absolutely flattened. That was just like, you know, Berlin after the war, parts of Cairn during the bad air raids, and we'd be down there, and then and they were Catholics, Irish Catholics, and every time you'd hear a bit of an explosion or a bomb, it'd be Jesus, Mary and Joseph, and the rosy beads would rattle, and for the first time I was frightened then, I was terrified, whereas before I'd had like bits of shrapnel all sorts landing around me, didn't give a damn, but you know, in the midst of all these prayers and screams, I was really frightened. The only thing that used to keep us going, really, was the fact that there was a theory that the bomb that was meant for you, you never heard. So you could hear all these whistles coming, the landmines, etc., falling around you. But if you could hear it, then you knew you were all right. But if you couldn't hear it, of course, that was... No, you didn't hear the one. Yeah, you never heard the one that was coming to you. That's right, yeah. Yeah, so as long as if you didn't hear it, you were dead. But if you did hear it, you were okay.
And which, I mean, there must have been different sounds that you, which, I mean, a landmine was a terrible thing because it was much larger.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Did you know about them and how they worked? And were you warned about them?
Oh, yes, there was a landmine. Landmines were dropped at St. Budo on St. Budo Square. There was Mr. Harding, he was a signalman, and since about probably 1850, there was a railway cottage on St. Budo Square, just like by the railway bridge there. And he came home from his shift about 5 o'clock one morning, and it was where the house had been, with nothing else around it, of course. It was just a house with nothing around it, and it was all... That was all gone, but his family were all right. They were because he came in and lodged with my aunt for a while because he had nowhere else to go. This was the trouble, that there was nowhere else. All the houses were bombed, there was, you know, nowhere to go anywhere. And when we'd be all the electricity would go, so people with gas or the gas would go, so. There was one person in our road that had an electric oven, which was quite unusual. So we all used to take in turns taking our having a roast dinner, and she would put it in her oven to cook it for us.
The really bad raid in Plymouth, which I think was in early April 41, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. There was a whole sort of series.
Was where the
Portland Square, I think.
And the bomb shelter was hit directly. Opposite
the China, that was in Portland Square, wasn't it? It was Portland Square, where I think.
Is that the one by the station? Where the station, North Road Station, used to be.
Back a bit, close to where Claire works now. And then there was also a bad one at outside what used to be the China Fleet Club in Devonport, just near where the Devonport Hospital used to be. I don't know if it still exists, Devonport Hospital, but. In one of them, they got the bodies up, but in one of them, they're still down there. They never got them up at all.
You were in Plymouth during that raid, were you? 41, April 41? I think it was April 41.
Well, yes, yes.
And what do you remember of that night?
Well, you see, when it's all crashing around you, you can't really tell that it's one night is worse than another night, and different areas of the town would be particularly badly hit. Perhaps Devonport might get it badly, or Cairn, or Cat Down, or somewhere like that. That there were, in those days we didn't go in for statistics so much, whereas today we would work out how many tons of bombs had been dropped to cause the effect. But it was just noise and rattle and inconvenience mainly, no food and I think we always had water. I don't think we ever lost our water, but electricity, of course, would go. And then the gasworks runs an awfully far away from us, so that was another cause for concern.
Do you remember coming out of your shelter and seeing an absolute amazement that, you know, houses had gone in the street?
Unfortunately, I can't quite remember where I was living. was I living in St. Budo or Keum? I mean, I can't remember which raid carried Notre Dame off. That's how I could gauge it more where I was.
Or of any of your school children, your school kid friends being killed, you know, contemporaries of yours.
Yeah, I can't remember now. I remember them being called out for the courageous, but I can't really remember people I knew being killed. Of course, there was always broken glass everywhere. That was a given. But there wasn't much terrible damage where I lived at St. Budo, and indeed, even in Keum, where we moved, there wasn't anything apart from glass and the odd firebomb, but there wasn't, or incendiary as we called them, there wasn't, I don't think there was a lot there, not actual terrible damage. It was more closer to the past the naval barracks that, of course, got it very badly.
And your father didn't sort of, because he would been going every work right into the yard where the bombs were falling, or most of the bombs were falling. Did he talk about it? If he had a loose bowel, he was probably quite a nervous man, I suppose.
He was. But people still went to work. Well, you had to earn your living, of course. They still went to work and still repaired the ships. So it's only in Malta, which was always the George Cross Island, the Navy will always tell you it wasn't the Maltese. First sign of a plane or an air raid siren, the Maltese all went underground. It was the British Navy, the sailors of the British Navy, that actually carried on loading the ships up and doing all that they had to do. The Navy was always very scathing about the Maltese Red Cross because they thought they were the biggest load of cowards going. Of course, these days that would be a racist thing to say, but in those days, you could say what you think.
So, anyway, there was big raids in 41.
It was absolutely endless. You'd go to bed at night knowing you were going to be woken up, and then it would go about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, and you'd be down there till about 2. And then sometimes you'd go back to bed, and then you'd have to wake up again and go down again. And this went on for months and months and months. So it became a fairly ordinary sort of thing.
I've heard that lots of people actually got out of Plymouth in the evenings and went up onto
the
wall.
They did. They did.
Did you do that?
No, we didn't do that. We wouldn't have done that in St. Budo. We would have thought it was a very poor class of thing to do. But the Keumites, the Catholics, they used to go up to Shaw Prior every night.
How would they get up there?
I don't know. It must have been by bus. And then at one time they went down and they lived in Cornwall for a while. But you know, we wouldn't have considered doing that sort of thing.
What about the visit of the King and Queen and Churchill? Because they came at that time.
Absolutely hated it.
Well, tell me about it. I mean, did you know? Tell me about the whole thing. When and how did you see them? Just talk me through it.
Well, of course, they wouldn't have announced beforehand that they were coming because the Germans would have raided whilst there and then. But they came to the town, both the King and Queen. I think they may have come a couple of times, and Churchill might have come a couple of times. And of course, we, being in a staunchly Labour community, because both my father was, and over at Keum with my other aunt over at Keum, she was staunchly Labour as well. And they hated the thought of Churchill coming. They said this would bring us nothing but trouble, and of course it did. Lord Holroyd announced that Churchill's been to see you today, you'll pay for this. And then of course when the King and Queen came, it was always the poorest sort of people, like Barbican people and Capdown people who were again like a different breed to us. Like I came from respectable working classes, whereas there's people in the depths of Devonport and around the Barbican where they really as alien to us as foreigners and asylum seekers come in today. But they would all stand around and cheer the King and Queen, because of course Nancy Astor, they were easily bribed because she used to give out sacks of coal in order to ensure that, you know, she got voted in every time. So they, you know, the people cheered them, obviously they were our King and Queen. But I know my family absolutely hated it because it meant that we would pay a terrible price, and we invariably did. There were hellish raids after the King and Queen had been there, and this rubbish of being able to look the East Enders in the eye once Buckingham Palace had been bombed, well, you know, we thought that was absolute rubbish. Not that we would have known such a thing at that time, but you know, the concept was there, the Queen sort of smiling with her ghastly clothes, and because my grandmother always said she thought she looked like an old troll, and she had no, absolutely no taste in clothes at all, so there you go.
So I see, so it wasn't that sort of blind patriotism?
No, not at all, not at all. I mean, in theory, King and Country it might have been, but for them to visit Plymouth was absolute disastrous for Plymouth. Well, that I remember, and you know, we did indeed pay every time we had a big name come to see us. There was trouble afterwards, so we just as soon do without them, really.
And there wasn't a feeling at the time. How do people know? I mean, there must have been a fifth column at work. Someone was actively reporting back.
Oh yes, obviously, yes. But Lord Hall's information was very, very accurate most of the time.
How would you hear Lord Hall?
Well, I didn't hear. Again, there's hearsay, you see, hearsay. But I remember that Lord Hall did say when the King and Queen came and Churchill came that you will pay for this, and we did. And we anticipated that we would pay, and sure enough, it happened, you know, that particular night. So, but it was... I don't think there were as many royalists down here as there are up around London.
If we say, so now we're into the summer of 41, I'm trying now to get some idea of and that was really entering the black period of the war.
Yeah.
There were many ships sunk crossing the Atlantic.
I can't remember when Tobruk...
That was 42, I think, 42? If I could be wrong. Which, the German victory, you mean?
Yes, and did the Americans land in North Africa in 43? And they gradually met up?
You've got me there, Mary. I'm sorry, I don't know about that one. But
and then they all went to Sicily.
That was, yes, in 40, but that was a bit later. I think it was in 44, I think. Because the Americans landed in the south of France from North Africa in 44, of course, same time as D-Day.
But Sicily came first, didn't it?
Yes, that's right.
And then they gradually went up in Italy. So I mean, it was always... To us, it was always the fighting in Italy. We didn't really know anything about the fighting in south of France. I think it was fairly secondary to the...
Well, it was very secondary, but it was a walk-in.
Monte Cassino and Alassio and places
that
like
that. That was a really harsh one. So anyway, I mean, so we've had the bad raids in Plymouth. It's 1941. You're now 11. What do you remember then of... Do you remember the first Americans arriving? Do you remember foreign troops being here?
Oh,
as
yes.
We sort of move through now into the...
Yes. The up at the... Close to that hill where I saw the planes, and there was a piece of land which had been... We always used to call this piece of land the camp, because in the First World War, the American soldiers had been stationed there. And after 41, they came back there. They went back to the same camp again. And that was all up... Just you pass the, when you come across the bridge, you pass that piece of land. They were all over the place. Of course, they were here in Saltash, and they were out at Plimpton, but that was the big camp there at top of Victoria Road in St. Budo. And then they came along Normandy Way to go down to the slipway down at Saltash Passage. And they it used to be Vicarage Road, and after the war they changed the name to Normandy Way, because that's the way the Americans had
went on D-Day. But I don't want to jump too ahead of my... I mean, how do you remember, say, I'm just day-to-day life then, in that sort of period of the war from 1941, say, through until 42 and 43, are there things that stick out for you then, as you were 12, 13, growing up a little, but were there still huge shortages? You mentioned the boredom before.
It's just boredom. No sweets. And of course, there was always sort of precocious girls and forward boys, but most of us were still children. But even at 14, you're still a child. You didn't have no talk about having babies at 12 back in those days. So there was nothing laid on for you and you just had to get on with it. And also, living over at Keogh, it was particularly bleak. I thought, now, my aunt in St. Budo would have had her rediffusion on all day long, so she would have heard news broadcasts. But over at Keogh, they only would put the 9 o'clock news on. Oh, and Itmar, we used to listen to Itmar, and that was it. There was no other. So there was no sense of any culture being exchanged. My father used to have the Daily Herald, and I think my aunt and Kim, they used to have the Daily Mirror. It was really only that day's headlines of the Daily Mirror which were of any interest. You know, we didn't.
What about the cinema and newsreels?
Oh yes. I think we carried on going to the cinema all through the war. You know, it's
even during the raids.
Oh yes, yeah. But this is sort of early on, and I know my mother must have been died. So it was after September 1940. But my aunt, the aunt that lived two doors away, and. Because my father and I would have our meals with them, she would cook for us. And I'd go to the state cinema, and there'd be the air raid siren, but some people would get up and leave, but, you know, we paid our, was it 9 pence, or was it 6 pence? I can't remember. Probably in the cheapest seat, 6 pence. And there's no way we'd get up and leave. You know, it could be time, but wouldn't dream of when there was a second feature in the news and all the adverts to see. And my aunt, there'd be bits falling around inside the cinema, and you could, like, the slates would be coming off on the outside and bits would be dropping all down around us, and still we'd sit, and my aunt and I'd be, I remember once that there was a Laurel and Hardy film on, and I still love them to this day. I was roaring with laughter, and my aunt said, "Stop that noise, I can't hear the bombs." So it's, but we still always went to, I don't think we went to Devonport to the cinema. We wouldn't have gone to Plymouth to the cinema, of course. But we had the state. But it only had one programme a week in those days. It only changed like every, and it wasn't open on a Sunday, of course. So it just had like Monday to Saturday, and then you had to wait to the next week to go again. So, but certainly once a week we would have gone. But I don't know how we managed for sweets, because. Always expected sweets in the cinema, so.
And food was difficult to get, or food was just
boring. Yeah.
I don't suppose there were many overweight people in Plymouth during that time, because it just wasn't enough to eat.
I can't really remember anyone who's even approaching obese, quite apart from like morbid obesity that you see around today. No one was.
And the black market? I suppose you were just a bit too young, really, to be involved in that.
Was a black market in clothes. You know, if someone knew, since you had someone who knew someone, might be able to get you something in the clothes line. And, of course, once the Yanks came, if you were a bit flighty, you could get nylons. Would it be nylon? Had nylons been invented? I think they had nylon stockings. Silk stockings, anyway. You could get stockings off the Yanks.
But, again, you were too young, Mary, I imagine. 14 or 15.
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah. No, I wasn't. Didn't go out with boys, so I was about 18, no, 17. No, so
what other things then stick in your mind of that period, 42, 43?
Oh, I remember there was a shortage of beer. Because my aunt used to do, her husband, my uncle, died, and she got a job in the as a barmaid. In the Blue Monkey, which alas is now all boarded up, and they used to have a lot of Americans in there then, and of course we'd never really seen black people before, and black people used to come into the Blue Monkey, and my aunt thought they were very nice, and then the white MPs would come in with a stick and bash them over the head, and though they hadn't done anything, and drag them out. My aunt always used to talk about that, how badly the Americans treated the black, you know, the American police treated the black American, even when they hadn't done anything, they were just, you know, beaten up. But there was a sad shortage of beer, I remember that. Yes, I remember. It's coming back to me now. I remember my father's shortage of cigarettes, shortage of Craven A. But beer was a great. If my father talked about anything, it'd be, you know, there's no beer in the Trelawney. They've run out of beer again. That was an absolute disaster. I think, in fact, they had to just start drinking cider, which wasn't really, which wasn't like a proper, like a man's, like your camera type of person wouldn't want to be drinking cider, but very often there's nothing else. And shorts, of course, whiskey and stuff like that was in poor supply.
And what about damaged shipping coming into the dockyard? Do you remember seeing any of that?
Well, later on, after the Battle of the River Plate, was the HMS Exeter involved in that? Was Exeter, Achilles, and Ajax possibly? But anyway, I think the extra was involved, and I lived at Keyham by this time, and I'd have to go to school and like on the Keyham bus, and it used to go by the side of the dockyard wall, and I could look over. I'd be always be upstairs, and the Exeter would be berthed there. It's all great holes in its funnel, and all over the holes all over the ship. But that was about the only actual damage I saw on the ship. They were probably kept. They didn't want people to see too much of what, you know, that been bad for morale. Morale was always very important. Whereas to see the Exeter, knowing that they'd been quite successful, hadn't they? It was all right for people to see the damage on the Exeter, because that would say, yes, we beat them.
That was the naval victory when the ship was sunk. Mm. What about school and keeping morale up at school? Can you remember what happened there? Were you given pep talks? Were you?
Well, no, because I don't. We may have been, but one accepted the way things were, and if there was a war on, well, you just had to adapt. You didn't expect the war didn't work itself around you. You had to sort of fit in with the war. So if it was it was just fact of life that all the talks in the world would make it go away, and make the fathers come home any or. You know, sooner, and put sweets in jars and stuff like that. So I can't remember what we did for clothes, school uniforms, because we had to wear a school uniform at Notre Dame.
But you were a secondary modern by this time, weren't you? You'd come back, or had the school been moved? How did?
Well, in terms of when I went to the secondary modern or senior school, as it was called then, and there was no uniforms there. Of course, the disadvantage then was I was 2 years at Notre Dame, 2 years at a secondary modern, 2 years at Plymouth High School, and the 2 years I spent at although I wasn't a particularly bright child, but it was a complete waste of time, really, because there were always three girls from Notre Dame. I know there were five of us all together, but they came and went, but there were always three Notre Dame girls in the school, and we were always took the first three places. No one else ever got a look in whilst we were there, and really everything they taught us, we already knew, so it was a complete waste of time educationally for me. So when I went to Plymouth High, I'd left Notre Dame in the second form, and I went to Plymouth High into the fourth form. So I had the most terrible struggle to keep up.
What happens now? Maybe we move through 43 into 44, and then are you conscious of the? I mean, there are more Americans around. It's the build-up to D-Day. What about that period then? I mean, and the war. People must have been talking about the end. Now the bombing raids have stopped.
Had the bombing raids stopped? I can't really remember. I remember June 6th, 1944, and the announcement coming over the wireless that the troops had landed in Normandy, and that was quite exciting. Of course, we guessed that all that was going to happen because of all the activity, and you can imagine all these thousands of Americans all over Plymouth, particularly just a few yards away across the water there, and all coming down to Saltash Passage to set off. That I don't know how they managed keeping all that a secret. They couldn't have, could they? We'd known about there was a big American secret of these about, I think it was between 800 and 900 men were drowned out at Slapton Sands, and which was all down, I think it was mainly down to British bad management, but was wrong radio wavelengths or something. But
how did you know about that? Because that was something that was kept.
It was a great secret, but it was something we'd always known. I don't know how we could have known it.
When did that happen? That was in.
Well, they were preparing. They used to use Slapton Sands because it was similar to some of the beaches they'd be landing on. So Slapton Sands, there's a lot of Americans stationed there. In fact, there's I think they dragged a tank out of the water, and they've got an American tank on the beach. They're still in memorial to the people who were killed whilst they did their training there. But
that was in 44 or the end of 43.
Well, I would have thought it was 44, getting close to the because I mean there were a lot of small ships out there, I think. But Leslie Thomas, who wrote Virgin Soldiers, didn't he? And he'd been evacuated to that sort of area, and he'd always been very interested, and he dug around and got to the bottom of this American, or as far as he could to the American disaster. And when he was talking about it on the radio one day, as he was talking about, this was, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, I knew everything he was saying. I knew it before he was saying. I thought, we always knew about that in Plymouth, about the Yanks being torpedoed, I suppose, by a submarine got in amongst them and shut them down. So, and yet apparently the few survivors were given quite an unpleasant time. No one would speak to them, none of the American nurses or anything like that, no one, and they were kept in quarantine where no one could get at them, and they had to sort of sign all sorts of things that they couldn't discuss it. But to say, I'm sure we always knew about it.
And in Plymouth, it was common knowledge.
It's just one of those sort of rumours.
And I think something like 500 or 600 men were killed.
I think it's more than that.
900?
Getting on for that, maybe like 857, something like that.
And you also said you had a friend who was up on Slapton Side.
Oh, yes, but that must have been about 1940 that she was there, and a plane came, she was there with a mother and brother, and a fighter plane came along one day and went up and down, machine gunned the beach. She didn't think, as far as she could see, no one was actually hurt. Perhaps they just did it out of spite, just to shake them up a bit, or if they were practising for Dunkirk, maybe. But that was quite a frightening bit.
So then, how are we doing for time? We've got, it's Mary or Reel 3. Do you want to stop, Mary? You're okay? You're okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Fine. So now it's D-Day has happened. What about the last year of the war? What are your memories of Plymouth?
You know, I'm afraid I can't really remember very much. I remember it was still dried eggs. And Spam, I love Spam. That was a wonderful American invention, Spam. Meat, of course, was still scarce. We used to eat a lot of rabbits. We always used to have rabbit pie on a Saturday, which was absolutely delicious. But then during the war, cats started to disappear. And apparently a cat, when its skin looked very similar to a rabbit, so we all stopped eating rabbits then. We were short of most things. People would say, this was when I lived at St. Budo, they'd got cups in Woolworths, and everyone would drop everything, dash up, catch the bus into Woolworths and queue up for cups. And the same applied, hair grips was another thing I remember, and when we dropped everything, and combs was something that we were so short of those like silly little trivial things which we now wouldn't give a second thought to. And then my friend was saying the other day, she remembered when she had an orange, her mother queued up for ages and ages, and she got some oranges, which a lot of children, of course, never seen an orange, didn't know what it was. And then, of course, didn't know what a banana was until well after the war. But, I remember in one of the big raids, when there were all the Navy used to keep its oil in the big tanks at Tor Point.
It still does.
And when that was bombed, that was spectacular because the